Good morning. Good morning. Come on in. So, according to the little gnomes that live inside my iPhone, it is 22 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. That means extra credit points for all of us. Just write it in your journal. Extra credit points. Made it to Zen Center when it was 22 below zero. It's beautiful, isn't it? Being in the city, we forget how quiet sometimes the snowfall and the cold makes the world. So it's one of my favorite parts about winter. And maybe it explains why our attendance at Zen Center tends to go up during the winter. It seems like a quieter, more naturally contemplative season to me. So there's an old Zen saying, I don't know where it's from, no snowflake ever falls in the wrong place. Isn't that nice? That person was not a Minnesotan. Except the ones on my driveway. No snowflake ever falls in the wrong place. I was looking out the window upstairs in the office waiting to come down here to talk to you folks, and was looking at the frost forming on the window. And this is an old building that has rather poor insulation, I'm sorry to say. And there's a place in the window where it's so thick it's just snow, totally opaque, you can't see through it at all. And then as that thins, you start to see the pattern. You know how frost forms patterns, and this thing in the middle that appears to be just random. At the edge you see, oh, there's a pattern. Actually, there's a pattern to all that. So no snowflake ever falling in the wrong place is kind of a nice way of expressing the sense of, I don't know, wholeness maybe, order, assembly that reality is constructed of. And we get a sense, we start to get a taste for that when our minds start to still, and when our hearts begin to open, we start to get a sense that everything is actually in a rightful place. So I hope you have a hint of that in your practice at some point. If that doesn't show up quickly, that's okay too. So this morning I'm going to talk about places and non-places. And that'll make sense to you here in a couple of minutes. I'll start with a really quick story. This is probably a year and a half ago. I'm not really good with time. But the last time I was in South Africa, I was in O.R. Tambo, the big airport outside of Joburg, Johannesburg there in South Africa. And I walked into the restroom. And I was met by the attendant. All the restrooms there have attendants, and I was met by the attendant who said, "Welcome, welcome to my office." And I noticed the restroom was spotless. And his relationship with that place, his caring for it, and also his enormous enthusiastic smile really changed how I perceive that space. Right? I'm going into a restroom. It is the place in our life, unless it's our restroom at our house, that we generally treat with the least awareness, the least mindfulness, the least respect. It is a restroom. I want to go into it and out of it as quickly as I possibly can. It is not a place that I value. I do not pay attention to my experience when I'm there, and I normally treat the objects in that space accordingly. Does that sound fair? Okay, good. People are nodding. Being met at the door, "Welcome to my office." I thought, oh yeah, that's right. This is your office. Like, this is actually where you spend 8 hours, or 10 hours, or 12 hours, I don't know. This is your job. This is your place. So when you visit a friend's house and they say, "Oh, welcome to my home," something does sort of click a little bit, I would like to think, in our minds about how we perceive that space. This is where they've chosen to inhabit. This is a place that has value to them. in our homes, in our offices, we bring our life. We bring our joys and our fears and our heartbreak and our daydreams, our fantasies. So, welcome to my office. Your toilet paper is Buddha, Katagiri Roshi used to say, which I just absolutely love him for saying that. I just love him for saying that. Your toilet paper is Buddha. What is the thing I have the least respect for? What is the thing that's the lowest? What he's pointing to is our discriminating tendencies, the tendency of the human consciousness to include and exclude, to attach value based on purpose, based on meaning, based on past experience. In the basement downstairs here at MZMC, there is a large closet right next to the restrooms down there that used to be a closet. We used to use it for just kind of a random assortment of items. My memory is poor, so I forget what was in there, but like rakes and shovels and some 2x4s and some folding tables. I remember those were really big old army canvas duffel bag, and I think some old curtains. And it's a closet. It's a closet. It's an ordinary, slightly smelly, boring and non-sacred closet. And about 8 years ago, our guiding teacher, Tim, ordained three more male priests in training, myself included, and we did not have any space. So we emptied out all the items in that closet, and we cleaned it, and we decorated it a bit, and we put in some robes, racks for robes, racks. We put in some shelving. We put it in an altar. And it's been the male priest changing room for, I don't know, 8 years or something. And it went from being a non-intentional, non-sacred, accidental place to an intentional sacred space. So, I'm going to introduce you to the term non-place. I learned this by accident when I was down the rabbit hole on the internet. And I came across a photographer who her project was, she had taken, it was a photography website, and she had taken photographs of people, portraits of people in non-places. And she said, if you don't know what a non-place is, please refer to this article. And the article was by a French, I think he's contemporary, I don't know, still living contemporary or recent, but a contemporary French philosopher, his name is Marc Auge, A-U-G-E, and he coined the term non-place. I don't know what it is in French. But what he wrote was, if a place can be defined as relational, historical, and concerned with identity, then a space which cannot be defined as relational or historical or concerned with identity will be a non-place. So I'm sure this is part of a longer treatise. The PDF of the thing he wrote, I found, was a long, 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 it was philosophy, so I said, no, I get enough of that. But this idea was interesting. This idea was interesting, and it brought me back to the restroom at O.R. Tambo Airport immediately. A restroom in an airport is not relational, historical, or concerned with identity. It is a non-place. And so he gave examples of non-places. Government buildings, train stations, restrooms, I don't know, I suppose city sidewalks up to a certain point. But any space you do not intend to be, you are there in passing. You are in that place in relation to a future place or a past place. It isn't a place you go to inhabit. Right? So like the DMV, that's a good example in our lives of a non-place. For a lot of us, the high school classroom, schools are that way. Unless you're a teacher, perhaps, in that classroom. But you get kind of what he's pointing to here? A place we don't choose to be, kind of have to be, generally shared by many, many people. And it doesn't directly relate to our sense of identity, our sense of history, and it's what we call non-relational. Thank you. So there's a very old saying in Zen that is one of my very favorites. There is no place to spit. A lot of you have heard me say that a lot. I really like that. There is no place to spit. What type of relationship with space does that invite us into? If I was taught immediately when I was very, very young, sweetheart, there is no place to spit, what kind of relationship with space would that have invited me into as I reinforced that idea over many, many, many years? And Suzuki Roshi said, when you take care of things, they will take care of you. What type of relationship with things does that invite us into? We are constantly, eternally in relationship with things and with space. We can't avoid it. You have never not been in a space. You have never not been in relationship with things. What Buddhism is pointing to here, and what Zen is reminding us of, is what that perception is, what that relationship is up to us. Is actually up to us. When Zen says there is no place to spit, they're inviting us to see the world as such. Take this as your aspiration. Do you notice in your life the places that you spit, either physically, literally, or metaphorically? Oh, that person, I always spit on them. They're invisible. They're a restroom attendant. That is a place I spit. It's a restroom. It doesn't matter. I don't have to bring myself to it. It's beneath me. It's not worthy of my awareness. It's not worthy of my attention. We do this a lot. When we come up against a saying like, there is no place to spit, wow, we see how few places we actually feel that way about. We really, really have very few places. So I listened to the instructions online for Zazen at a Zen center. Some Zen centers put talks online the way we do, but this Zen center had their instructions for Zazen, for our seated meditation, online, as well as a recording of how of their etiquette class. They had an etiquette class. This is how you treat the space. And they had a recording of that online, too. It was pretty cool. So they were talking about, we bow and we enter the room, da-da-da-da, here's what we do with the altar, here's how we whatever. And at one point, the person, and we do those things here at Zen Center, too, during formal settings, so as not to be confusing. We don't normally do it on Sunday, but I don't want to confuse anybody who's here today and wondered, oh my God, maybe I was supposed to do something. You're okay at Sunday. you're okay every day, but on Sunday here, you're really okay. What the person said was, so we bow and we enter this space because it's a sacred space. It's a zendo, it's a meditation hall, it's a sacred space. And then when we're leaving, we bow when we're on our way out, we bow out. We don't stop and turn back around and bow back in to the sacred space because we're bowing out because now that's the sacred space. And what this person said in their instructions was, it isn't that this is actually a sacred space, it's a space. We treat it as if it is sacred to remind us that it also is and to remind us, oh, this is the thing I put in my life to remind me that every space is sacred. So by exercising the muscle called this is sacred space here, I get a strong enough muscle that I can carry it into the foyer and then maybe out onto the porch and then maybe outside to Lake Calhoun and then maybe to my car and then maybe when I go home and then maybe to the restroom at O.R. Tambo Airport, right? It is inviting us into this there is no place to spit by we treat one thing as if it's amazing to remind us that everything is that same way. So our relationship with things, our relationship with places, does not tell us about those things and those places. It tells us about ourselves. The room we're sitting in was once a living room. What's behind me right now that we call the altar was once the fireplace. Right? This is a single-family home. It was built as such. This was not a Zen center 50 years ago. It became a Zen center about 45 years ago. So 50 years ago, this is a non-sacred space. 45 years ago, it became a sacred space. So this is not about redecorating. That's not what I'm talking about. The closet downstairs, this room that became a zendo, this is not about redecorating. This is about something that happens inside the human heart, that happens inside consciousness itself. There is a way of treating things that makes them come alive. There's a way of treating places that makes them come alive. the relationship that I saw in that man's eyes and that man's smile over that restroom was relational. It became alive. Right? This is something that happens inside of us. And that's the invitation of our practice. Right? There is no place to spit is an aspirational statement. That's a statement of our aspiration. I desire to see the world that way. I desire to see the world as a place of uninterrupted sacredness. Nothing is left out. So in Bodh Gaya, India, there is the tree that they call the Bodhi tree. And they claim that this tree is a direct descendant of the original Bodhi tree under which the Buddha attained enlightenment 2,500 years ago. It's huge. I've seen pictures of it online. And it's a pilgrimage destination for people all around the world, for Buddhists. They'll travel for a long ways to go and see this tree. And we have trees, of course, around us all the time. They are normally, for us, non-objects, I would suggest. Unless they're especially beautiful, unless they're especially meaningful for us personally, they are normally regarded as non-objects. That tree in Bodh Gaya, India, we have collectively decided is an object. That's a real thing. Right? That's not a non-space, that's a space. It's not a non-object, it's an object. And personally, it would never occur to me to leave an empty Coke can on the pew of Chartres Cathedral. Right? Or Notre Dame. It would just not occur to me to leave an empty Coke can there. Right? But I might well leave an empty Coke can on a bench at the Greyhound station. Because, number one, the can is empty. It is now a non-object. Right? It is not serving me. It is therefore not of use to me. Ta-da! I can exclude it. I can just leave it. That's why we call it trash or litter. When it was full of Coke, it wasn't trash. Right? I'm done using it. Its value has gone from, $2 to zero, which means in my heart of hearts, it's gone from mattering maybe a little to mattering not at all. I would never think of leaving it on the pew at Chartres Cathedral because Chartres Cathedral is, right? It's a place. And people have agreed that it's a place for 1,500 years. Notre Dame or someplace like that. Ooh, the Greyhound station? That's a non-place. Mark Augay is right. That is a non-place. That's the way I'm going to find myself relating to it. Leaving a Coke can there isn't even littering. It's like you're, who cares, right? A non-object left in a non-space. So it's fun to start playing with this. Just kind of use your imagination to play with the things you're wearing, the space in which you're sitting, the chair, the car you drove here on, the things you've used today, the things you've thrown away. Just play for a little while in your imagination. Over the next few days with just places and objects and how you notice your response to them. And one of the cool things about this is, I fully expect, it will show you how utterly arbitrary they are. They're just arbitrary, and they're very self-centered. Like, if this serves me, it has value. If it doesn't, it doesn't. It really shows us how, I mean, it's sad, actually, but it shows us how deeply that wiring goes. It shows you how deeply that wiring goes. My favorite example is if someone gave you an old stained white piece of cloth, ugh, that's a non-object. If they said, oh, that's the Shroud of Turin. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And you, of course, could argue, as people have been doing for several hundred years, whether or not that's an object or a non-object. Isn't that interesting? If we could prove definitively this is the cloth that wrapped Jesus of Nazareth, it would become of inestimable value. If we could prove conclusively, nope, it's just a piece of cloth, we could pitch it. Right? The cloth is the cloth is the cloth. The world is the world is the world. And yet, what's in my own narrative about it changes everything. So the Bodhi tree would be sacred to a Buddhist and maybe just a tree to somebody else. I heard that in the rabbinical tradition of Hasidic Judaism, they say, if you want to find a good rabbi, watch how she treats her shoes. Don't ask her a bunch of questions about Torah and don't da-da-da. Just watch how she treats her shoes. That'll tell you everything you need to know about that person's heart. Does she include them? We have the very same thing in Zen, right? You guys have heard the very same thing in Zen. When I first came to a talk here, under Tim's guidance. I was away from Zen Center for many, many years, and when I came back to see the new guy, it was on a Sunday, and it happened to be during Rohatsu, and I'd been away for a long, long time. And the first thing I remember being shocked by was hair. He had a lot of hair. He's got a great head of hair. And so I was like, ooh, I don't know about this guy. That's funny, isn't it? That's really funny. But I don't know about this guy. And then I just watched how he treated his cup. It might have even been this one. I don't remember what the talk was about. Who cares? But I watched how he treated his cup, and I decided, I like this guy. I want to get to know this guy. I'm going to set up a meeting with this guy. I think he's the real deal. So we're taught in the Zen tradition, we have lots of sacred objects, even though nothing holy, nothing sacred, but we have lots of sacred objects and lots of sacred things, sacred places that teach us how to do this. One of them is the robe, the okesa, the full-length robe that ordained priests wear, and the rakusu, which is a small version of that same thing. And when we sew one of these and we receive it during the initiation ceremony or the ordination ceremony or the transmission ceremony, we are taught to treat it with great respect. Be very, very intentional about it. Keep it in its case when you're not wearing it. Put it on the shelf outside the bathroom. You know, bow before you put it on. Say the verse of the robe to treat this object with great, great respect. And the cool thing about it is the tradition, I mean, now we just use whatever's cheapest at Joann Fabrics. That's about as close to non-object as we can get here. But the original tradition was a robe is sewn out of cloth that's been thrown away. In India, that's how you do it. It's the cloth that's been thrown away. It's cloth that's used to wrap people when they're going to be burned. So they'd go to the charnel grounds and find old pieces of cloth that were body wraps, menstrual rags, people throwing rags out on the street, just whatever cloth happened to be there, stuff that has been discarded. You would then take, you'd clean it the best you could, you'd dye it all roughly the same color, and then you sew your robe out of that. So the most sacred object, the robe of Buddha, was made out of stuff that everybody else had said, this has no value to me. I have thrown this away. So the tradition around the robe starts with, we're going to make our identity object, the thing we're going to wrap ourselves in, so that you can see visually, oh, you must be a follower of the Buddha, you're wearing the Buddhist robe. We make that out of what others don't want, what others have purposefully chosen to discard. Dogen uses the term pure cloth. It is therefore pure. It has been thrown away by everybody else. It is therefore pure. It will give rise to no greed, no attachment, no desire in anybody. They're not going to go, ooh, I love that, I want, right? Oh, I love your purse. Oh, I love your, right? So like the silky brocade one with the big dragon on it. Ooh, I mean, it's pretty hard not to want that, right? That's groovy. That's cool. Oh, yeah, this is made out of rags I found on the side of the street that we dyed all the same color, and it was stuff that used to be full of blood and pus. No, that's good, cool. I'm sure it looks good on you. I don't need to try it on. You're fine. Right? Isn't that a brilliant... I mean, that's a brilliant and fascinating statement on object versus non-object. This is going from the most non-object thing possible to the most object thing possible. You're seeing my theme here, I hope. Again, our relationship with these things tell us about ourselves. They tell us about ourselves. And the most recent example of this for me was recently I was in downtown Minneapolis. I was called to jury duty. Jury duty. I got 2 weeks of that. And when I started jury duty, they usher you into this big room. There's 100 of you sitting around, and you're waiting, and you might get called, you might not, the whole deal. Those of you who have done it know what I'm talking about. And at some point I was called and went into a courtroom, and, you know, we have plenty of time to talk to one another, the people who have been called, and mostly it's, I'm trying to run a business, and I'm on my phone all the time, and this is such an inconvenience, and they don't help you pay for parking, and this is just the worst. It's just funny how much humans complain. I just think it's funny. God, consciousness and form and this constant dynamic unfolding of phenomena, and I'm just utterly dissatisfied with it. That is inherently funny. Wow. Life is showing up wrong. I want it to be. Anyway, another talk for another day. That's actually funny. So we're all complaining bitterly because it's what we do. And we're finally called in, and I forget all the details. But anyway, at one point, we have to be sworn in. And then be interviewed. And the judge, she was a Hispanic woman, young, I thought, anyway, which says more about me than it does about her. But anyway, Young, she said something that made me do a total 180 on my relationship with the entire experience. She said, before we do this, I just want to remind everybody in the room that jury duty is part of being a full U.S. citizen, just like voting, and that thousands of people over hundreds of years have fought and died for what you have the right to do right now in this room. And I was like, oh. And she said, blacks did not be able to vote. Native Americans did not be able to vote. Women used to not be able to vote. How long ago? Not very long. 1920. Less than 100 years. So this is my great-grandma. When she was born, she was, in at least that way, a non-person. And in 1920, we decided collectively, she is a person. Wow. Less than 100 years. So suddenly, because of what she said, just like being greeted at the restroom in O.R. Tambo, my relationship with that space and that time and what I was there to do changed. And I was like, wow, this is actually sacred. This is actually really important. And yeah, I am inconvenienced. And yeah, a lot of this is boring. And yeah. But it's taking place within a container that I realize has tremendous value. Kind of like Zazen. Really inconvenient, oftentimes boring, taking place in a container, right? Like, yeah, I've had some miserable experiences sitting in this room. I know a lot of us have had miserable experiences sitting in this room. I keep coming back. Right? This is a place for me. This is a place. This is a place. So what I realized in O.R. Tambo and what I realized and was reminded of in this jury duty experience was I love non-places. I have my whole life and I didn't know it until this, but I all of a sudden realized I love inhabiting non-places. In fact, I wrote 3/4 of this talk in a Subaru dealership waiting for my car to be worked on. I was just sitting there and realized I'm really happy. That's weird because I'm sitting in a non-place that's full of old magazines and, you know, there's a TV on in the background and nobody's paying attention to it and people are trying to ignore the space as much as possible. You're right, they're there not by choice. They're there because their car's broken and they want to get out of there as quickly as they can. And I was just aware of, like, how the chairs were worn and the shine on the coffee table and the way the old magazines had been kind of folded or sort of neglected. And I realized my heart actually opens. This is just me, you guys. I don't know why. Weird. My heart opens in a non-place. I like to be in a place that people pass through and they didn't choose to be there and they do not choose to abide there. But I like being in those places because I have this sort of sense that maybe they're really hungry for awareness, that somehow they're starving for attention because they're always ignored. That says something about my mind. But for me, it's like being in a waiting room or on a train or in a Greyhound station. I relate to those spaces like they're unclaimed puppies at the Humane Society, and everybody passes them over and passes them over and passes them over and passes them over because it's not a space worth paying attention to. And when I allow myself, like, I'm actually going to inhabit this space, I'm going to fill it, I'm going to notice it, I'm going to be present to it like it was Orioki, like it was a robe, like it was Chart Cathedral, like it was the Zendo at Zen Center, it rises to meet me in exactly the same way those other spaces do. It turns out those spaces are lacking nothing. I could argue in my brain about the aesthetics and da-da-da-da-da, but that's actually not what I'm there to do. You know, through the lens of the heart, through the lens of non-judgmental awareness, non-discriminative consciousness, wow, my experience rises to meet me, and I find those places as whole, and I can see beauty in them, just the way I can in a space that invites me, more obviously, to do that. Wow. Wow, that was really neat for me to notice. I really, really am grateful that I figured that out. And why that happens to me. I love those spaces. I kind of sense how thirsty they are. And when I was in high school, this is way before 9/11, when I was in high school, I took a class in creative writing that had just been invented that year by some guy they brought in. He had almost no budget. And so he took us on 2 field trips with the little budget he has. And the first one, This has nothing to do with my talk. I'm just telling the story now. But the first one was to, he said, well, we're all going to go to the Hungry Mind bookstore in St. Paul, which is one of the few independent bookstores that had a huge selection of poetry at that time. And he divided up the budget for that trip into just cash and then gave it to each of us. Like, here's your 20, 20, 20, 20, 20 to all 10 kids or whatever who are crazy enough to take creative writing, and said, just buy some books. Whatever, I don't care. Just buy some poetry and we'll put it in the library. That's it. That's our field trip. How cool is that? He totally empowered a bunch of snotty-nosed 16 and 17-year-olds who were just going to go find the dirtiest thing they can, which we did. It was just Bukowski, 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 you know. Wow, put it in the school library. I was like, wow. He was fantastic. Well, the other thing he had us do, I'm really off the talk now. He had us go outside onto the football field, and he said, everybody lay down. So we all lay down on the football field. He said, write down the furthest away sound you can. What's the furthest away thing you can hear? So we just laid there for like 10 minutes and just like, oh, there's traffic. And then you realize, oh, actually, beyond that, I can hear a train. I didn't know there were trains. And then beyond that, I could hear. That was actually mindfulness. I mean, he probably didn't know that, but that was really, really cool. Anyway, the story that's relevant. The story that's relevant is the second field trip and the rest of his budget, he took us to the MSP, to Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, which, again, this is 9/11, before 9/11, so he could walk right up to the gate, the whole deal, right? And just said, all right, you guys got 3 hours. Meet you back here in 3 hours. Just go out to a gate and write. We're like, well, how come? He said, because, and he didn't say non-place, but that's the spirit of what he was doing, because you are in a space people didn't choose to be in, but it's a particularly human and dramatic space because this is a place where people say goodbye, and this is a place where people say hello. And both of those are really emotional. So I want you to watch these people saying hello and watch them saying goodbye and write their stories. Just tell us what happened, you know. Fill in the rest, right? That's creative writing, just to invent this narrative about it. Man, I loved it. And I said, I love airports. People are coming and going. They're very dramatic, and they're very cranky, and they're bitter, and they're running because they're late, or they've arrived 4 hours ahead of time, and they're really bored, or they're falling asleep, and you get to see their face when they're all soft. And you actually get to see people who are like in the same space for the first time in however long, and they see each other, and they start to run to actually touch each other a couple of seconds quicker than they would if they didn't run. That's amazing, isn't it? I love you so much that I'm not going to wait the full 30. I'm going to run so I get there in 20. Right? Ugh, that's beautiful. Wow. In a non-space. So, in the Narita Airport, which is the main Tokyo airport, it's outside of Tokyo, there's a sign as you come in that says, welcome to World Sky Gate Narita. A lot of their translations are close. I have come to the conclusion I like this way better. World Sky Gate. The same thing as airport, right? A port is just, oh, it's a place on the land that connects to the ocean. It's a port to the... And so an airport is, oh, it's a place on the ground that's a port to the air, right? World Sky Gate is the same thing. Well, it's a gate to the sky of the world. World Sky Gate, Narita. So I saw that sign and went, oh, man, there's a Dharma talk there, so I wrote it down someplace. And then when I was at the Subaru dealership, see, I put it all together. This is what we do, right? Wow. So I had plenty of time, a long time, like 23 hours or something, to think about World Sky Gate, because that's how long I was there. And I loved it. A gate to infinity. A non-place that's a gate to infinity. And I went, oh, that's Zazen. Everything's Zazen, you guys. But, wow, that's Zazen. I spent enough time in airports in the past several years that I've done a lot of travel to realize that not only are people unusually unguarded there, I don't know why, we're there to witness one another, but there's something about these places. We actually get really intimate, strangely. You never talk to each other, but you're willing to sleep in front of one another. You know, you're willing to be upset in front of one another. You're willing to be angry and cranky or cry. People cry freely at airports. I just think that's interesting. There's something about them that sort of strips away some of our normal ego armor. And it's a wonderful place. All non-places are, but airports and that kind of place are also really wonderful opportunities to do the... I love you exercise, where you just think to yourself when you see a stranger, I love you, just to see how that changes your experience. You just think to yourself, oh, I love you. It just as you're passing person after person, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. To see how that softens your heart? I would put this under the category of right effort, you guys. Cultivating the seeds of loving kindness, the seeds of unconditional positive regard. Hello, person I've never met. I want to start with, yes, you're included. I love you. That actually softens your heart. Do this sometime. And if you can't get to I love you, at least do I see you. I see you. I see you. If you say this out loud, you're going to get in trouble. So just do it to yourself in your head. But try this. This is your homework. As an experiment, when you're in a non-place next time, at the DMV or at the airport, and you got, you know, half an hour to kill and you're sick of angry birds, just look around the room and just see what happens in your heart when you say that to yourself while looking at a stranger. Or even somebody who isn't a stranger. I love you. 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 This is taking a non-person and turning them into a person. A non-place, turning it into a place. Right? I see you. We do this to our own consciousness on the cushion in Zazen. When we're doing Zazen and fear arises, I see you. I feel you. Hello. Right? That's what we've been taught to do. We meet it. Hello. You are not an unexplored territory for me. You're explored. Come. I see you. I feel you. Hello. I will let you in. Include everything. That's what Zazen does. What I hear. What I see. What I feel. Hello, thoughts. I see you. We let it all in. And the invitation there, it does make us big, doesn't it? When you realize at some point on the cushion that you're a big enough container, that even your edges get gauzy and you can't find them anymore, and no matter what arises in your consciousness, it's fine. It's not going to constrict you. It's not going to throw you off. It's not going to push you backwards. It's not going to cause you to reach forward with greed. It's no problem. Old memory, heartbreak, dream, sleepiness, irritation. Hello. Whoosh. Right? This little tiny body, this little tiny self that sat down on the cushion has become a gate to infinity. It isn't even me anymore. It isn't my consciousness. I'm just swimming in it. It is me. We're not thrown anymore. Everything's included. There are no non-spaces anymore. There are no non-people anymore. There are no non-objects, non-things anymore. Everything gets an equal showing. Zazen's very democratic in a sense, in that way. So, the World Sky Gate thing reminded me of one of my favorite Duran Duran lyrics. This is Dharma, you guys. Duran Duran actually is from the Sanskrit. It means Dharma Dharma. I'm lying. That's not at all what it means. It's from a bad movie. They say, reach up for the sunrise, put your hands into the big sky. I realize when I'm standing outside, I'm touching the sky when my hand is right here, as much as I'm touching it when I'm reaching up, as much as I'm touching it. If I could somehow put my hand out the plane window at 30,000 feet, I'm all equally touching the sky. And I normally think, just conventional consciousness, when I'm looking up at the sky. I'm not in it, but I am. Like, where does it start? Right here. This is it. You can't not touch it. When you put your paw up, you are touching it. In fact, even when you don't put your paw up, right now, you're still touching it, right? The distinction between not sky and sky is just as arbitrary as the distinction between non-space and space. Wow, I'm touching the entirety of the sky with this one little paw right here. Wow. That is an instruction in Zazen. Is the enlightenment that you want going to be later or higher? Or somehow do you imagine that the mind you bring to the cushion is somehow not that? That you're somehow missing it? I love silly teachings like this in a way because they just remind me, you can't miss this. This is a mark you cannot miss. You can't not touch the whole sky. Every moment touches every other moment. We've never had a separate moment. It's impossible. Every space touches every other space. Even with doors and walls around it, it is not actually separate. We made that up. Every space touches every other space. Every person touches every other person. Moment is just moment with a capital M. There is just moment, and it is undivided. So everything arises together. Places, things, people. sounds, impressions, memories. All these things arise together. And when we allow ourselves in Zazen to let this thing that we think is so real, that provides this barrier, when we let that begin to dissolve, very patiently, very gently, we get a sense of the openness of this. We really do get a sense that it's us who makes the walls, the limits, the barriers, the gates, the non-places, the non-things, the non-people. We create all of that, and it's not real. It's not real. We actually aren't separated. There isn't a gap. So, to close today, I just want to encourage your sitting practice. Of course, that's what every talk is always about. Do this yourself. Touch this yourself. You know this yourself. This is about you. And hopefully framing Zazen as a practice of non-spitting. Zazen is inherently non-harming. There isn't anything we do not allow. It does not condemn. It does not judge. It does not criticize. It does not eject. It does not exclude ever. It is a stance physically with your posture and with the heart and the mind. It is a place of non-harm and allowing. It is a, I am not going to spit for 40 minutes. And that everything that shows up is a place, a thing, a thought, a memory. It is something that is real. It is something that is worth being experienced. It is worth connecting to. It is worth touching. It is worth allowing. It is worth including. There are no non-places or non-things in Zazen. Zazen is a world sky gate. It is small and personal and at the same time infinite and universal. And therefore, there is no place it does not reach. Just like Dogen says, there is no place, that airport, there is no spot on in the sky of the earth that airport does not touch, and there is no place that your Zazen does not touch. It's not a separate thing. And the invitation of it is, make your place a place. Make the person a person. Meet it with kindness. Don't exclude. Notice how you do and relinquish that. This moment is not an ordinary moment. This moment is moment. And that's not the way we usually experience our life. So it's a radical invitation. We're used to Zazen around here. We get used to it. So we start thinking it's normal. And it's funny. We forget how radical it is. How radical the invitation is. How big the freedom it invites us into actually is. How boundless. So, wherever you are, what you are seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and thinking is your life. And whether or not you experience this moment as a moment or a non-moment is up to you. Whether or not you experience the people in your life as people or non-people is up to you. Whether you experience your teacup later during tea as an object or a non-object is up to you. Whether or not you experience your life as sacred or not is up to you. It is up to you. No one else has the ability to tell you any of those things. It's up to you. Actually, everything's up to you. That's all I have, I think, today. So thank you very much. 45 minutes. Good boy. We have some time, so if anybody has questions or comments or good airport stories, this would be a good time. Hi, Charlie.
As I was coming in, I also noticed the beautiful sun and the sun dogs. I don't see them very often, but talking about places and non-places, would the sun dogs that you can't ever get to, would that be a place or a non-place?
Ooh, good for you. You've been hanging out here a while, haven't you? What do you think?
Boy, that's a tough one.
You want to switch seats? I love, actually, that's a great example, Charlie, because that kind of stuff, you know, they say it depends on where you are and how you see it and da-da-da-da-da, you know, that somebody else could be seeing the very same sun the very same day, but not see the sun dog depending on where they were. Very much beauty of this is in the eye of the beholder kind of a thing. But I love the idea that, like, walking down a sidewalk, the most boring thing in the world, non-place. I look up and see a sun dog, and suddenly I'm transfixed, and I stop in my tracks, and I'm, wow, I'm beholding something amazing, and it does change my heart. All of a sudden, I am standing in a real place. That's a great example of that. Thank you. Jason.
I also risk asking questions I don't have answers for.
Yeah, historically, that's been the case with you. I love that. What?
Following on that, maybe there's folly in looking at some places as sacred and others not.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we feel the need to go on vacation?
That's a great question. That's a great question. We do inhabit those spaces differently, don't we? Yeah, vacation is an especially good example because, like, if I was a millionaire, I thought, well, this is a good time of year to go to Tahiti. I'd take off for Tahiti and I'd spend it in a hotel room, which is a non-place. So I'm not going to probably make the bed in the morning or treat everything in that room particularly well. And yet, I wanted to go there and I can hardly wait to be there because that's a special place. Like, Tahiti is a place. Yeah, it says a lot about the way we relate. I'm just personally fascinated about the way humans relate to objects and spaces. I just find that interesting because I understand that at some level it's arbitrary. But at another level, there really is a genuine resonance with, like to go on vacation means you have to leave your normal space. That's part of how you leave the space in your heart and your mind that you normally occupy, that going to Tahiti or South Africa or wherever will literally get you out of that emotional place, that place of thought that we normally occupy. There's something special about that. And I have to admit, as much as the teaching is, nothing holy, nothing sacred, or everything holy, everything sacred, there are places I've been that it was really hard to not think, I think even objectively, this is an amazing place. Ted gave a fabulous talk a couple of years ago about Pipestone, his experience in Pipestone, and my wife and I were on a road trip out west, and I was telling Ted, and he said, hey, well, if you have a chance, go to Pipestone. So I said, oh, we got it. And we went to Pipestone, and I'll be darned. Oh, yeah, that place is juicy. And I thought, well, so now am I experiencing it as juicy because Ted told me it was juicy? And like that's what I came into it. I don't know, maybe. Maybe, I don't know. It's a great question. I don't know.
Actually, maybe part of it is when you return, you see the sacred.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I've heard people say that a lot over the years about this place. They come in and go, wow, you can feel it when you come in. And I'm like, hey, yeah, I've been hanging out here a long time, so this is just normal for me now. I'm the frog being boiled, and I don't notice that it's... That's a really bad metaphor. Sorry. I'm the frog ascending to enlightenment, and I'm not aware that I'm... There it is. Ah. But, they're like, oh, this place, it's morphic resonance or whatever. People have been sitting zazen in this room for 45 years, and it seeped into the walls, and you can feel like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. And other people just go, oh, it's so small. I don't know. Wanda.
Do you remember the story that Tim has told before? And I think it was Alan Watts, but you can correct me if I got the wrong person. He went to Japan, and he visited a monastery there, and the monk was taking him through the monastery and giving him a tour, and he kept stopping to bow at all the statues and bodhisattvas and Alan Watts finally got frustrated, and he said, what are you doing all this bowing? This is Zen. We don't worship. We don't have deities. And the monk just smiled really big, and he said, okay. And then Alan said, I could spit on these things. And he said, okay, I bow, you spit.
I think that is Alan. Is that Alan Watts? Sorry, darling, I'm asking you, because I know you're an Alan Watts person. That sounds right. That would be a good one, too. I'll bow, you spit. Bow nine times, spit once. All right, well, thank you, folks. I appreciate your time and your attentiveness today. When you leave, please stay warm. Stay warm. It might be a place and it might be sacred, but ooh, baby, it's cold.